Since the 1800s, Hickok & Boardman Insurance Group has been providing quality service and peace of mind to our clients. With our offices in Burlington, Stowe, and St. Albans, and our Dennis Ricker & Brown offices in Montpelier and Lynnonville, we are here when you need us.
And now WDEV FM and AM presents our two-hour public affairs program, Open Mic with Mike Smith. Important topics, topical guests, and your phone calls. And now here's the host of Open Mic, Mike Smith.
Good morning, everyone, and thank you for joining us this morning. It's great to be back with you this morning. The cough there. I don't know what's going on. Hey, if you're doing a rally, if you're doing a sort of a rally, if you were listening to the news, can you tell me those students were really excited about being out there and protesting? You know, Hey, come on, let's go. So what did you think of the debate, the governor's debate last night on WCAX? Who won and why? This will be one of the questions we ask in the first 30 minutes of the program today. And there's a public poll out now. VPR has released their public poll, along with Castleton Institute, on the statewide elections. What did they say, and who's in the lead, and who isn't in the lead? And also today, on today's show, joining us in studio will be Burlington resident Jared Carter, who is opposed to the Burlington Downtown Redevelopment Project. He'll share his reasons why he's opposed to this project. And Amy Matinat, you know Amy, she's pretty much an expert on car repair. She'll share with us, I've always been interested in this question, so she'll share with us her answer to this question. How do you know that of the skill level of the mechanic that's working on your car? And plus, she'll discuss other automotive repair issues as well. But let's get right to politics this morning. What did you think of the governor's debate last night on WCAX? Who won and why? Give us a call at 802-244-1777 or toll free at 877-291-8255. In a little while, I'll start talking about what are you looking for in the presidential debate tonight. But first, let's concentrate on the governor's race. Who won the debate last night? Who won and why did they win? Now, VPR has released a poll this morning at about 7:45, or maybe it was around 8 o'clock, that shows that the governor's race is a dead heat. It's 39% Scott, 38% Minter. It's a little interesting because this far out, you should not see this many undecideds at 14. So who knows where the poll is and what it's capturing. It went over a two-week period. That's a little bit much because you don't catch trends coming in to the later part. You don't catch people moving, the movement in that. But right now, according to a VPR poll, this is statistically tied. Just to give you some other sort of poll results, 43% for Zuckerman, 26% for Brock. You have Milne at 22%, Leahy at 59%, Trump at 17%, Clinton at 45% on the polls. So give us a call, 802-244-1777 or toll free at 877-291-8255. Who won the governor's debate last night? Who won and why? Be interested in your opinion. You know what was interesting to me? That this debate last night, if you were going to shine in a debate, last night was the debate you were going to shine in. CAX did a very good job at sort of integrating not only panel questions, but audience questions and online questions as well. And they did a very good job with this head-to-head debate. This was probably one of the first times, at least televised, one of the first times that you really saw the head-to-head differences between the two candidates. And I guess, you know, if you look at it, what Phil Scott needed to do in this debate was contrast himself from Sue Minter. He had to be more crisp in terms of his answers. He had to be genuine in his answers. And he needed to stay on his own message, which was the economy. And if you look at what his objectives were in this debate, did he meet them? On the other hand, Sue Minter, you know, she had to... Here was the two objectives that Sue Minter had to do. One is she had to convince voters that she is not a continuation of the Shumlin administration. And she had to settle on an issue where you identify with her. Who is Sue Minter? And in that immediate word, when you think of Phil Scott, you think of the economy. He's really embraced himself. He's wrapped himself around the economic issues that are out there. So who won the debate last night? And why? Give us a call at 802-244-1777 or toll free at 877-291-8255. Let's go to Ruth in Sheldon. Ruth, you're on Open Mic. Good morning.
Yes, I watched the debate. I thought it was run well by WCAX. And I thought Phil Scott won the debate because Sue Minter promises all these free programs. She's going to have free college education, free daycare. She's going to raise the people's wages and everything, but she doesn't really explain where all this money is going to come from, and I don't believe her. I know she can't do all those things. She's not going to do all those things, so I thought Phil Scott won very easily.
Well, Ruth, thank you for your call. I really appreciate it. Ruth thinks Phil Scott won the debate last night. It's going to be interesting what others think as well. Rama from Williamstown. Rama, you're on Open Mic. Good morning.
Good morning. I don't know about win or loss, and I just watched a debate this morning on CAX, of course, a recorded version of it. I will say this for Sue Minter, in that she has actually done a really good job of, you know, people were kind of writing down her chances early on, but as the polls show, she's pretty dead even with all those undecided. She could easily win this. The only thing I want to call into question is when you say that one of her tasks was to really kind of separate herself from being a continuation of Shumlin. And to some degree, you're right, but that's more of the personality of Shumlin that you need to separate from. There were a lot of projects that Peter Shumlin embarked on as a governor that have been popular across the state. It's how they've been carried out, which has been less than popular. But I would say that, you know, where you have somebody like Sue Minter who says, yeah, I'm going to carry on pushing on about this bit about global warming. I'm going to continue on trying to do something about gun violence. I'm going to continue on with doing the standard whatever about jobs. I don't know. That's kind of when I hear governors or governor wannabes talk about how they're going to create jobs, it kind of makes me wince. But that said, I don't think it's that she needs to avoid being a continuation of the Shumlin administration. She needs to be avoid being a continuation of Peter Shumlin on a personal level.
Thanks, Rama. Let's go to John in Burlington. John, you're open mic. You're on Open Mic. Who won last night and why?
Good morning, Michael. I think if you're a Democrat, you think Sue won. If you're a Republican, you think Phil won. First of all, Sue needs to be given tremendous respect for showing up last night, given the tragedy at Harwood High School, which affected her family directly. Secondly, Phil Scott is very shallow on his answers. Sort of like Donald Trump, when he's asked what his plan is, he says, I have a plan, I'm going to cut spending. Very, very shallow. And thirdly, where was Bill Lee last night? When you had a debate, Phil didn't show up when Bill Lee wasn't there. So what happened last night?
Don't know. You're going to have to ask Phil Scott about that. Don't know. But, John, thank you very much. Let's go to Bill in Moortown. Bill, you're on Open Mic. Good morning.
Yes, good morning. Hey, this is the best show you've had in a long while. I tell you something, Phil Scott won that hands down. No problem at all. And there's no way that Miss Minter can ever come in there and replace Phil Scott. And I'll let it go right there at that. Have a good day. Thank you.
Thank you, Bill. Let's go to Eric in Johnson. Eric, you're on Open Mic. Good morning. Who won the debate last night, Phil Scott or Sue Minter?
Hey, good morning, Mike. I thought Phil won, and I'll give you two examples. it was really interesting on the carbon tax or gas tax question to Sue, and she highlighted that the global warming is our biggest problem, which I agree with her on. However, in her answer, she highlighted how we didn't get any snow last winter and that how important the ski industry was to Vermont. Well, the ski industry is one of Vermont's largest carbon contributors. So here's her answer is about carbon, and she's highlighting how great the ski industry is. With all those people driving up here and the snowmaking and the lifts, it was very hypocritical and ill-informed. Not to mention that the ski areas are responsible for our high electric rates. Then the second thing that I thought was really odd that Sue did was bring up, she asked, when she had the opportunity to ask Phil a question, she said, do you support Trump? Well, Phil was one of the first Republicans to come out denouncing Trump a year ago, and I think that goes to Phil's great credit, and he's got my vote for that. So.
Eric, you're absolutely right. Thank you for your phone call, Eric, but you're absolutely right. I thought she wasted a question. What the format that they had, and it was similar to what we did in Tunbridge as well, the format that they had is that each candidate could ask the other candidate a question. And the question that Sue asked was about Trump. And I thought it was a wasted question because it gave Phil an opportunity to talk about why he isn't supporting Trump. And I don't know what she expected to get from that question. And one of the questions I think that at least that I thought was, why ask that question? It was a layup for Phil Scott to come back on with that question. Now, when you set those questions up, you're looking for to do a certain thing. You're thinking of dividing Phil Scott's support or taking Phil Scott's support away. I don't think that question did it last night. I think it just gave him an opportunity to reinforce some of the things, and he was an early, basically he came out opposing Donald Trump very, very early. I think it was last September. I think it was on this show that he did that. And one of the things that I thought, you know, as Eric said, I thought that was a wasted question. So what did you think of the governor's debate last night? Who won and why? Give us a call at 802-244-1777 or toll free at 877-291-8255. I thought CAX did a very, very good job last night with their debate. And it was a debate where you sort of had to shine. It was the time to shine because I bet that was probably the biggest audience that they've had for a debate. And it was head-to-head. There was no sort of distractions on this. It was head-to-head, and it was a good debate. We learned a lot about the candidates. And I think any objective analysis, and, you know, I think one of the people that called in said, you know, if you're a Democrat, you're still going to support Sue. You think she won. If you're a Republican, that you're going to support Phil. That wasn't who they were after. They were after those people who haven't decided and are independent last night. And I think if you look at it objectively in this way, I think Phil Scott probably had the advantage last night. I mean, he contrasted himself with Sue Minter. He answered his questions in a more crisp and seemingly genuine way and less rehearsed than Sue did. He was successful at staying on his main message, which is the economy. And as you all know, the economy is the number one issue. You can take all the issues, and actually in the VPR poll, it sort of confirms it today. If you take, you know, the economy is number one. Economy, jobs is number one. And then budget, I think, or it's vice versa. Budget, you know, cost of living, those sort of things. They're number one and two. And they always are, by the way. And I thought Phil Scott did a fairly good job last night of staying on message about the economy. He seemed more at ease last night than I've ever seen him before. And his closing statement, and this is where you go to the voters and you say, this is the reason why you should vote for me. I thought his closing statement was the best that he's ever done, and I thought certainly it was better than Sue's last night. I thought Sue Minter had some effective moments. I thought she had some effective moments talking about our debate in Tunbridge, for example. But she wasn't consistent in her performance. She seemed ill at ease. And this was especially when Scott would sort of push her on her stances on things. She became, I thought, ill at ease at that. She was fidgeting a lot, which I don't know what that was all about. You know, they've been through several, they've been through primaries, they've been through debates. It's probably, you probably get nervous, I understand that, but you shouldn't be overwhelmed with nervousness at this point in the campaign. I thought, as I said before, I thought she wasted that direct question. And when the candidates are allowed to ask those questions, and Rama brought up this point with Shumlin, it's his personality. No, it is about his policies as well, and she needs to separate herself more from his policies. People, if you look at some polls, people are not thrilled with Governor Shumlin and some of his policies, especially in health care. And she needed to sort of separate herself from there. I don't think she accomplished that task. And like I said before, did she identify herself with an issue that people can say, Sue Minter, that's our candidate because of X? And I don't get that sense that she did that last night. So we're asking the question this morning, who do you think won the debate last night on WCAX, the governor's debate on WCAX? Was it Sue Minter or was it Phil Scott? It's been divided on the question. Let's go to Joanne in Williston. Joanne, you're on open mic. Good morning.
Good morning. Well, I am a Republican, and I thought Phil did a wonderful job, and he'll be a wonderful governor. I just wish he had brought up the point, and if it's true what I think I read in the papers, Sue Minter would go against a town vote who had voted against installation of windmills. Mm-hmm. She would override the people's wishes and put these windmills in, which I am so against. They're taking the tops of these mountains for future generations. And I just can't imagine anyone taking a whole, I don't even know how much cement is, but I think they take a whole acre for each windmill with solid cement. And how many birds, how many bats, how many eagles are being killed? We never hear those figures. And so I hope Phil will have an opportunity again to point this out, because in Vermont, it is so against the Vermont style of going against the town's wishes. So that's my say.
Thanks, Joanne, for your phone call. Obviously, the wind issue is a big issue with many people throughout the state, and it will be interesting how much it will swing this election. Right now, the VPR poll has Scott up by 1 point. It's within the margin of error, 39% to Minter's 38%. Is statistically a dead heat is where it is right now. And I think that's where most people feel it is. Now, whether the numbers are right or not, I have a quibble with whether it's 14% undecided. I just can't believe at this point in the game it's 14% undecided. But we'll see. I think generally it's probably that way, that it's fairly close, that Scott is probably up a little bit, but not a lot. And it's going to be interesting what happens here in this election. So what did you think of the governor's debate last night? Who won and why? Let's go to Sam in Williston. Sam, you're on open mic. Good morning. Hello, Sam.
I think who won last night was the people of Vermont. You know, nationally, we've watched two candidates that everyone feels like they have to plug their nose to make that choice. And we've got two governor candidates who are talking about the issues, talking about Vermont, the state we all love, and what they want to do to make it better. And whether you agree with both of them or not, you know, we're going to get a chance to have a new governor and hopefully head in a new direction, so that we quit losing retirees, we quit losing businesses, we focus on our economy so we can get after some of these other important programs that support the residents of this state.
Thanks, Sam, for your phone call. I think, you know, Sam, you hit on a really good point here. I thought it was a very proper and respectful debate last night. Now, they disagree on directions, and I get that. But they were very respectful of each other. It was not like perhaps what we're going to see tonight or perhaps what we've seen before in the presidential debates. But it was a very respectful debate. And actually, they said very nice things about each other when they were asked this question, what would you say nice about your opponent? And they were very respectful answers to one another. I thought it was actually very, very well done. Let's go to Jerry in Barrie. Jerry, in Burlington. Jerry, you're on open mic. Good morning.
Good morning. I think Phil won it, and I don't think she made any points with a guy from Bluesville, because her answer, all she talked about was downtown Barrie, Waterbury, and St. Albans. That doesn't help the rural areas like Bluesville. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Really appreciate it. One of the things that is interesting in this VPR poll is that 56% of the people that are paying very, very close attention to this election support Phil Scott, 31% support Sue Minter. So what does that mean? If they do have a large undecided vote here, and I'm a little skeptical of this undecided vote, but if they do have a large undecided vote, does that mean once they start paying attention, will they go to Phil Scott? So who won the debate last night and why? We'll take a few more phone calls. If you have time, we're going to wrap this up in a little while. So if you want to call in now. The phone number is 802-244-1777 or toll free at 877-291-8255. Great debate last night. I hope you agree with that. Great debate last night. Congrats to WCAX for doing a great job with a head-to-head debate with the two main candidates. Poll results are out this morning. Scott is up by 1 point. It's a statistical dead heat. The VPR Castleton Institute poll, 39% to 38% with 14% undecided. If you want to know what the other races are, it's Zuckerman at 43%, Brock at 26%, Leahy at 59%, and Milne at 22%, Clinton at 45%, and Trump at 17%. Again, I have a little bit of an issue that there are 14% undecided, but, you know, I think generally if we were talking about polls, I think, as I said earlier, Scott probably is up by a little bit, and it is close. So with that said, we'll move on to our next segment. Jared Carter will be joining us right here in studio, and we'll be talking about the Burlington Downtown redevelopment. This is Open Mic. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. It's my pleasure to have joining us in our WDEV studios, Jared Carter. Jared is in opposition of the Burlington's downtown redevelopment project as it's currently designed, and we're going to be talking about that because we had the mayor in a couple of weeks ago, I think it was, talking about why this development project is needed. So, Jared, let me first welcome to the open.
Thanks, Mike.
And secondly, why are you opposed to the Burlington redevelopment, the downtown redevelopment project in its current form?
Yeah, well, first of all, Mike, I appreciate you having us in here to chat about this. I think it's an important moment for Burlington. I guess I would start my answer to that question by making the statement that Burlington is an exceptional community. We've been a national leader on so many fronts historically, and I want to see Burlington continue down that road. So it's not that I'm opposed to development or growth or economic opportunities that come along with that, but I think if you look at this proposal, it's a bad deal for Burlington. And as the voters go to the polls in a few weeks, I think they need to be looking at this as really a moment of truth. Are we going to take option one, which is the 15-story, 14-story zoning change and the TIF, and basically, in my view, subsidize out of state investors, make the wealthy more wealthy, or option two, which I think is the way that Burlington has made itself great to begin with, is investing in people, investing in North Street, not Wall Street. So all sorts of other ways we can spend our limited tax dollars to really invest in people, get that multiplier effect, rather than subsidizing wealthy out-of-state investors who are doing just fine in this economy. People are struggling. Let's put our limited resources into people, not out-of-state development entities. And so I think that's why it's a bad deal for Burlington. I also think, Mike, if you look at the proposal, the reasons we've heard why it's such a good idea are the ones I hear, environmental. It's going to stop sprawl. We've got to build up and not out. And there might be some truth to that. But I don't think the way this is being proposed that it's going to have any impact on the sprawl going out outside of Burlington. Are we going to stop developing in South Burlington or Williston? No, none of that's going to happen. And so we're trading off our public asset, which is our community scale skyline, for something that's not going to get us those environmental returns in terms of stopping sprawl. Economically, sure, it might be nice for a few people to be able to buy a couple pairs of jeans and some wealthy folks to be able to buy condos. But the people in Burlington are not going to directly benefit from this, I don't think, in any significant way. So I don't think it's going to have a benefit. And if we're going to spend significant amounts of taxpayer dollars on this project, then you gotta be investing in people, not Wall Street.
The mayor says that this is an opportunity that may not come around again, and the city will miss an opportunity because, I guess, I don't know if you'll concede or not. I mean, the downtown mall area seems to be dying, and this this would revitalize that dying structure, I guess is the word to say. Mm-hmm. How do you respond to that?
I think if you walk down Church Street, and I was out there yesterday evening, it was a beautiful fall October day. Using the word that the downtown is dying is so far from the truth.
Yeah, that's my word. Okay. That wasn't the mayor. But what the mayor said is this is an opportunity that may not come around again.
Mm-hmm.
So let's start with that question, and then we'll get to the mall question later.
Look, the idea that folks that are opposing this are just standing in the way of progress and are the status quo is I think, a false notion. The opportunities that are coming along, again, let's talk about the opportunities. I live in the old North End, Mike, and that's an economically struggling part of Burlington. I sit on my front porch, and I watch refugee mothers who have come to Burlington from war-torn parts of the world, and we've opened them with open arms, welcomed them, and that's tremendous. I see them picking through my recycling bin on recycling day for bottles, presumably to feed their families. You want to talk about an opportunity? Let's invest in those folks. Let's not spend $22 million investing in Wall Street. Let's invest in the most needy, and I think you'll find that that's going to pay the most economic return. We could talk about investing in things like microloan programs for folks, entrepreneur training for low-income folks and immigrants. You walk through the old North End, and there's businesses opening. These people want to engage in the economy. I think if you get out there and you invest in the people, you're going to see much more returns that stay in the community rather than go into Wall Street. So that's why I say invest in North Street or any of the other communities around the city, and not in Wall Street. So I think it's a false notion to say that this is the only opportunity we have. Burlington is not anywhere USA. The status quo is investing in Wall Street, investing in 15-story trophy towers. Leading is really getting back to what made Burlington great in the first place, and that's investing in the people and the public.
We're speaking with Jared Carter, who is obviously an opponent of the Burlington Downtown Redevelopment Project, and would welcome your phone calls, your thoughts on Burlington, the direction that Burlington should be going. Give us a call at 802-244-1777 or toll free at 877-291-8255. Would you concede that the mall aspect of downtown, it just isn't working the way that it was designed to work?
I mean, sure, the businesses in the mall seem to be closing. I don't know whether that's by design or that's simply market forces at work. But again, I don't think the mall anchors Church Street. I think Church Street was essentially subsidizing or anchoring the mall. I don't think we need a new mall. I don't think we need a whole slew of new condominiums. We need to invest in people. We need to get back to what makes Burlington great, made Burlington exceptional, make Burlington a leader nationally. We don't need Anywhere USA.
So you would take the money sort of that is earmarked, whether it's the TIF money or anything else, it's earmarked for this project, and divert it for other projects. You talked about, I think you said incubators or something along that line. Yep. Can you just explain that a little bit more, how you would do that?
Absolutely. So one of the rationales that I've heard about this TIF is that, well, it's going to create economic activity. Ultimately, after we've paid it back, there's going to be growth. People are going to see this economic benefit.
And that's what TIFs are supposed to do.
Absolutely. And there's probably jobs that will be created. I think most of them are going to be low-paying service industry, the Gap, J. Crew, $8-$10 an hour, which, fine. There's some benefit to that. What I'm saying is, and I think if you look at the basic economic principles, when you invest directly in people, you're going to get a better return. When you invest in the community, you're going to keep those dollars here. I just paid my property tax bill as a Burlington resident yesterday, and I'd much rather see that money go to folks that are struggling on my street to grow businesses, to go back to school. Let's think about what the real problems are facing the community of Burlington. We've got, 15,000 students going into tremendous amounts of debt. We've got elderly folks that can't afford their prescription drugs. We've got refugees who are having to pick through the recycling bins to feed their families. We've got folks with mental health issues, substance abuse issues being banished from Church Street. There's a real crisis going on, and I think folks that are promoting this development are out of touch with what's really happening on the streets in Burlington. And if we want to see economic growth, if we want to see a strong and vibrant community, which I believe we all do, then I think we've got to get back to basics and get back to investing in people.
We're speaking with Jared Carter. We're talking about the Burlington Downtown Redevelopment Project. That's the mall project, basically, for those people who are familiar with downtown. If you want to join our conversation about this project, obviously, we had the mayor on a couple of weeks ago. He's in support of this project, this redevelopment project. We have Jared on today, who's opposing this project. Give us a call at 802-244-1777 or toll free at 877-291-8255. Let's go to Margaret in Montpelier. Margaret, you're on Open Mic. Good morning.
Good morning, Mike. I just wanted to add that I am very against this. One of the things that came out just a couple of weeks ago is that the market feasibility study that was finally done by somebody named a Doug Kennedy Advisors out of Norwich, Vermont. The public version says redacted. And what that means is that anything that had anything to do with money got redacted from the public version. And the reality is this is public money. We're talking about handing a developer $21.8 million of taxpayers' money, and to have a public version redacted, those two, public and redacted, don't belong in the same sentence.
Thanks, Margaret, for your phone call. Let me ask you that, Jared. I mean, there are some things that people want their finances redacted because there are some reasons for it, but is this a good reason to have information redacted?
Yeah, I'm not specifically familiar with the redaction here, but I think there are certain laws that protect people's privacy, and those are important, no doubt about it. But I think when you're talking about the public domain, we should always err on the side of sunshine is the best disinfectant, and so unless there's very good reason to redact things, I don't think that should be going on. And the bottom line is, look, the public is going to have a voice on this. And I do. I applaud the mayor for bringing this to the voters in November. And I applaud the folks who are working very hard in Burlington to do the same, particularly the Coalition for a Livable City. So the people are going to get to decide this. And I think and I believe that when they're looking at all the facts, the people of Burlington, by and large, agree that when we talk about our limited tax dollars, we should be talking about investing in people, not the profits of wealthy out-of-state financiers.
There seems to be a large contingent of support on this. I mean, you have former Mayor Clavel coming out in support of it. Mm-hmm. You have environmental groups and business leaders coming out in support of it. How much opposition in Burlington is there to this?
I've had my house flyered a couple times. So I think there is a pretty strong opposition. Quite frankly, I think you're right. There are groups that have come out and supported it and former mayors that have come out and supported it. But I think when the people of Burlington, remember, those are who are going to get to decide, not the environmental groups, not former mayors, not the current mayor. The people of Burlington are going to get to decide. I think when they look at that ballot and they say, geez, do we want to send $22 million to Wall Street, or do we want to keep that here in our community where our people are struggling? And do we want to turn over a public asset, our community scale skyline, to a developer? I think they're going to say no.
Let me ask this question, because I want to make sure that I understand this correctly. What you're saying is, let's leave well enough alone in the downtown. Let it go in whatever direction it's going to go. Let the market forces or whatever it's going to happen. We won't unify the street, but we're going to invest in the neighborhoods, the communities. Is that what you're saying?
I think ultimately that's correct. Obviously, those aren't, you know, investing in a micro loan program for immigrants or an education program or a commission to study how to deal with student debt. All of those things that I think would be important to Burlington and make us a leader again are important, but I don't think, and I think it's obvious, those aren't on the ballot. I'm just pointing out that when we're talking about limited tax dollars, where do we want to spend our money? Where do we want to spend our money? Are we shipping it out of state for some marginal return and a giveaway of our skyline? Or are we going to look at a better development plan? And I'm sure there's development plans that could be achieved that would satisfy the objectives of affordable housing, reduction in sprawl. But it's not just going to happen by cutting a ribbon on a 15-story trophy sticking up above Lake Champlain, Mike.
We're speaking with Jared Carter, who is opposing the Burlington Downtown Redevelopment Project. If you wish to join our conversation, the number is 802-244-1777 or toll-free at 877-291-8255. Where do you stand on the Burlington Redevelopment Project? Are you for it or are you against it? And what are the reasons why? We'll return in a moment and continue our conversation with Jared Carter. This is Open Mic. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. A couple of weeks ago, we had the mayor of Burlington on talking about why Burlington voters should support Burlington's downtown redevelopment project. And it needs a couple of voter approvals, zoning changes, TIF using and bond use in this area. TIF, by the way, is tax incremental financing. It's a state program. But today we have in our studios Jared Carter, who is a opponent of this downtown redevelopment project. And if you have an opinion on it, give us a call at 802-244-1777 or toll free at 877-291-8255. I left George sort of hanging here, so let's go back to the phone lines. And George from Burlington. George, you're on Open Mic. Good morning.
Thank you, Mike. Good morning. I have several things to say here. Number one, I, too, live in the old North End of Burlington. I've lived in the old North End since the 1980s. I've lived in Chittenden County my entire life, and I'm almost 67 years old. I thoroughly support this program, this whole proposal. Number one, there's nothing wrong with a city having a skyline that's a little bit taller than what we have in Burlington now. This is, after all, a city. There are a number of excellent development projects that are on the drawing board, proposed, or getting to the construction stage in the city of Burlington these days. This is one of them. Obviously, it's the biggest one. But I think that it is important for the growth and the vibrancy and the development of the city that it continue to build things like this, that it continues to grow and breathe, and it breathes life into the community. I, as I said, I live in the North End myself. I see the same people that your guest sees, and I want as much of the best for those folks as possibly can happen, but I see this as two entirely different subjects. He's bringing up A in order to oppose B. I don't see the connection. And the other thing is, I mentioned all those other development projects that are proposed in the city. I'd like to know if your guest can in any way support any of them, or if he is, as I think, an obstructionist who just opposes any kind of developmental projects. And I'll hang up and listen. Thanks.
Thanks, George. Are you an obstructionist?
Absolutely not. I appreciate the comments, George, and nice to know I've got a neighbor out there. I'm not an obstructionist, and I don't think the folks that are opposing this development are either. In fact, I know they're not. There's no doubt we need investment in our community. There's no doubt we need development in our community and job growth. But I do think there is a direct connection when you're talking about a vision for a community. And yeah, we're legally a city, but ultimately a community, investing in projects that are, I think, completely out of sync with the rest of the community, and are essentially subsidies for folks that don't need them. And so when I'm talking about opposing this, I'm really looking at this from the perspective of, where do we need to invest our scarce resources so we can help the most people? And I see people struggling all over Burlington. And so my vision for the use of these funds, my vision for the city of Burlington, would be one that invests in the folks that are needing to dig through bottles, invests in folks who are struggling with substance abuse. The old North End. I leave my trash can out overnight after pickup day, and I find used needles in it. We got a serious problem. Why are we sending $22 million to Wall Street when we've got that going on? I don't buy it.
Let's go back to the phone lines. Let's go to Denise in Burlington. Denise, you're on open mic. Good morning.
Hi, this is Janice Grill. I'm with the Coalition for a Livable City. Thank you, Jared, for giving a shout-out to our efforts. Obviously, I'm in agreement with Jared, but I wanted to make the point that the Coalition for Livable City is not at all against developing or increased density in the downtown core. We, in fact, support what Plan BTV, our comprehensive plan, and our municipal plan say about increasing density in the downtown core, and that is that we want that, but we want it to be within our current zoning. There in Plan BTV, which costs the city millions of dollars and, you know, thousands of people engaged, that's what we come up with. We come up with saying that we can do a lot more within what we have now as our zoning, and what's happening with this is that the zoning is being broken within basically a 150-day period against the expressed will of the people in Plan BTV and in our current zoning laws, which were had height restrictions at 105 feet with public bonuses in 2009. And what's being done is we're raising the height and mass increase, the height increase from 65 feet by right to 160 feet by right. And that means we're not getting what we usually get in other parts of the city, which is better public benefits, or any public benefits, in exchange for increased height. The developer is being asked to give the same amount of public benefits that he would give in other parts of the city for 65 feet to get 165 feet. So as Jared says, this is a bad deal. The city's not bargaining for us, and we're concerned about that, but we're especially concerned that the public planning process, which is something that happens to protect people, protect the city from, you know, outside interests. The public planning process, which is what we said we wanted for the future of the city, is being completely overturned because one guy comes in with $200 million. In Plan BTV, there was a survey of respondents who described the future of Burlington in different ways. And out of 169 people who answered this little survey, only one person said they wanted the city of Burlington to be taller.
Thanks, Denise, for your phone call. I'm going to try to get one more in. Paul from Moncton. Paul, can you be real quick here? I want to try to get your phone call in, but we're running out of time.
Okay, I'll try to be quick. 2 points. First of all, it's a false narrative to say that we can't have that building and also have projects and money and you know, a future for refugees and people who need help because of, you know, whatever issue they have. That's just a false narrative. There's money out there to be worked with. Secondly, and generally speaking, for the state of Vermont, this is the problem we have. We are a third world state. For every dollar we send Washington, D.C., we get back almost $1.50, and that's because people like this refuse to allow any growth or any business to be created that will generate tax revenue.
Thanks, Paul, for your phone call. Jared, just because we're running out of time, I got about a minute and a half here. Sort of sum up why you're opposing this one more time.
Absolutely. So I appreciate the calls. I don't think it's a false narrative. I absolutely agree. We've got limited resources to spend. We shouldn't be giving away our skyline without receiving due benefits. So development, sure, but let's keep it within Plan BTV. As the people decided on previously, and let's get back to what make Burlington great in the first place, and that's investing in people directly. You're going to see much more economic growth, I think, if you do that than if you invest in something that's completely inconsistent with our community and completely inconsistent with the plans that have been put in place and the zoning laws that were put in place to make sure that Burlington stayed a vibrant community.
I think I got about 30 seconds that I can ask this question. It's unfair to you, but I'm going to ask it anyways. What happens if you lose?
Well, what happens if we lose? That's always a chance, of course. And if the people of Burlington decide that that they want to move forward with this, then absolutely. That's the people have spoken, and I would certainly support that. I'm still not going to support this plan. I hope we can continue to have conversations and make it better. That's what a vote's all about. That's what democracy, as you know, Mike, is all about. I'm going to work as hard as I can to make sure that the people hear the truth and vote accordingly.
Jared Carter, thank you so much for coming in today.
Great. Thanks so much for having me, Mike.
And thank you for all the callers on this particular subject. I really appreciate it. Coming up, Talk Media News, and then Amy Matinat will join us. She's the owner of Auto Craftsman. And I have this question that I've always wondered about. How do you know the skill level of the mechanic that is working on your car? I just, you know, I always get these things of whether I'm getting ripped off or not on a car. And this is Amy. I brought Amy in to sort of answer some of these questions, plus any other car repair. This is Open Mic. And you are listening to locally owned and operated WDEV News Radio on the Friendly Pioneer, celebrating its 85th year anniversary this year. That's right. We've had a glorious past, but we're celebrating the future. 85 years, WDEV News Radio. You're listening to WDEV AM 550, broadcasting from Waterbury and Montpelier, 96.1 FM from Warren, 96.5 FM from Barrie, 98.3 FM from Montpelier, and serving the kingdom at 101.9 FM from Island Pond. Of course, we're streaming worldwide at WDEVradio.com. By the way, you can go on that website, WDEVradio.com, and listen to Open Mic anytime by clicking on the Open Mic podcast. This is Mike Smith. I'll be right back. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. We now turn our attention to national issues, and the big national issue is the debate tonight. Ellen Ratner from Las Vegas. Good morning, Ellen.
Good morning. It's hard to believe how many gambling events and activities there are in this town. I didn't remember it so much, but of course the biggest gamble is the debate tonight. And although we have decided on the topics, and including the debt is one of them, and this is going to be Chris Wallace's big night, and he's been working very hard on this. And also, he's a very hard one to, if he says be quiet, to not be quiet. I mean, I think he's a very tough cookie. But each side has got to decide how to play it, and that's, we haven't seen any WikiLeaks or anything on how they're going to play it. But the Hillary has to decide, is she going to be the sort of policy wonk that she's known to be, or is she going to be tough on Trump? And Trump has got to decide, is he going to go after his base to get them out by saying, you know, the election's rigged and all that kind of stuff that he says that helps his base go, or is he going to act presidential? And that's what we don't really know.
It seems like Hillary Clinton is sitting on a lead right now, and what does she have to avoid tonight?
Well, she has to avoid looking harsh. She has to avoid looking mean because people don't like a harsh, mean president. She's got to look policy aspirations. She has to give real solutions to things like our debt, which has a lot of Americans concerned. She has to get that crossover voter, the people that would either stay home or normally, or perhaps, not normally, but perhaps vote for Trump, and will take a second look at her. That's the crowd she's got to get, and she's got to get millennials. And it's very interesting, last time in the spin room, after all of this going on, one of the things that I saw was that Trump had some young people out. Hillary did not. She had a lot of her older people out. She's got to get some younger people in that spin room, people who can speak to millennials. That's who she needs.
What's interesting to me is Donald Trump seems to abandon all sort of strategy other than building up the base, getting the base excited, and getting them out to vote. He doesn't seem to be interested, or at this point in the campaign, of trying to generate any crossover vote. Does he have to be? Does he have to be his firebrand self tonight in order to do that?
I don't think he does. I mean, I saw him after the New Hampshire primary, and frankly, I thought he looked very presidential. Now, that was just me, and in fact, somebody at Fox, after the Cleveland convention, said to me, well, are you for Trump? I said, no, but I'm calling it as I see it. He did look presidential after that.
What will be the main points on this debate? You talked about debt, but Chris Wallace has a list of various things that he's talking about.
Right, and they've been going after with the candidates, as I gave you the list. But debt is certainly going to be one of them. Some international policy will most likely be it, although in previous debates, one of the debates has been devoted to international policy. That has not how they've dealt with this.
You know, what's fascinating to me, and I'll ask you some other questions as well, but one of the things that pops out at me is this Julian Assange sort of drama that's happening at the Ecuadorian embassy in London, where his email accounts have been cut off by the Ecuadorian government. Does the U.S. have any involvement in this at all?
Well, they're claiming they don't, and I believe they did. Now, Truth in Advertising, my brother Michael Ratner was Julian Assange's attorney before my brother passed in May. He had quite a bit to say. He loved Julian Assange. But, you know, again, we don't know. I mean, the American government is saying, oh, we have nothing about it. But, you know, in the business, it's called plausible denial.
Right, that somebody's talked to somebody else that talked to somebody else.
Exactly.
What else is happening, Ellen?
Okay, well, it's interesting. The National Enquirer says that they have a person who's willing to show documents saying that he arranged for Hillary Clinton and Bill Clinton to have sexual affairs with men and women and whatever, whatever. But the National Enquirer, when they gave out the story today, or last night actually, they didn't say who this person was. So, you know, you got to say who the person is. So that's going on, as well as it looks like ISIL has taken Mosul. And, well, they haven't taken them, but what they've done is they've put various landmines around to prevent the other people, the folks trying to take it with American help, to take it back and to get into Mosul. So we got an international crisis on our hands in that respect.
You know, you want to sort of discount the National Enquirer, but then you got to look that they broke the John Edwards story as well.
Right, but on the other hand, I picked up a National Enquirer recently because I wanted to see some of the stories, and I knew some of the people and the stories, and I didn't think they were accurate. So, you know, we're going to have to see. It depends on what they have and if they really have documents and if the documents are true documents.
Ellen Ratner, as always, you know, put a bet down for me out there, would you?
You got it. Thank you.
Ellen Ratner from Talk Media News. Thank you so much for joining us. Coming up, how do you know the skill level of a mechanic working on your car? That's one of the questions I have, and one of the questions I'm going to ask Amy Matinat from Auto Craftsman in just a moment. This is Open Mic. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. How do you know the skill level of the mechanic working on your car? That's one of the questions we're going to pose to Amy Matinat today, owner of Auto Craftsman. She's here at her WDEV studio, sitting right across from me. And I just found out she's a Supertramp fan because she was dancing to Supertramp here. Good morning, Amy.
Good morning, Mike.
So how do you assess the skill level of the mechanic that's working on your car?
You know, it's such an important question. If you think about it, they're car doctors because cars are so complicated and they're systems. You can almost like look at it as a system in your body. You know, you have your circulatory system and you got your digestive system. Well, cars have systems also. So your car doctor really needs to have the skill, the expertise, the experience to be working on these systems because they keep your family safe and they keep your investment that you've put all this money in your car, they keep it rolling on the road. So it's interesting that in the United States, mechanics are not licensed. Anybody can go buy a toolbox, hang up a sign, and start working on cars.
Even me?
Yeah. Yeah,
that's a scary thought.
That's the reality of it. So in 1972, a nonprofit group was created, the National Institute of Automotive Service Excellence, and they created a certification program. So you have to have 2 years' experience to be even able to start become certified, and then they have a testing program. So they have tests in there's 8 basic tests for the auto repair part of the industry. They also have tests for bodywork, for the parts guys, for service writers, a lot of different tests for people who work on school buses, which is all important stuff. So the 8 basic tests are engine repair, automatic transmission, manual drivetrain, suspension and steering, brakes, electrical, heating and air conditioning, engine performance. And so if you think about those 8 tests, that's a lot of information to know about.
Hmm. One of the things that I've always been interested about, if it's like a medical doctor, should you ask for a second opinion?
It depends. I think like a medical doctor, the best way to get the best care for your body, your patient, and we'll say the patient is the car, is by creating a relationship with your car doctor who has the skill and expertise. And if they're communicating in a way that you can understand, and to me it's all about communication. And cars are so complicated, I call them computers on wheels, and they just keep getting more and more complicated. So a good car doctor has good bedside manner, and they're able to explain to you in everyday language and I think the best way is to show you. So when you have the weird noise or the car's acting funny, the best thing you can do is ask your car doctor to go for a ride with you. So instead of you trying to make noises and, you know, explain what the car's doing, you can be driving down the road and say, that noise right there, or did you feel that right there? And then your car doctor, who has the experience, the expertise, the skill, is going to say, okay, now I know where to look. And then the next best thing is when they get the car up in the air or they find out what it is to bring you out in the shop and show you. And so that way you have a visual, and then they explain what's wrong and how they can repair it. And then there is the estimate to fix it. But I feel like a good car hospital, which is what the auto repair shop is, their job is to find out what's wrong, just like a hospital does, explain it to you so you can understand how much it's going to cost to repair, and then you can make an informed decision. Because there's a lot of decisions to make. Sometimes it's like, okay, I can't afford that now, but it's so unsafe, I need to park it until I can save the money. A lot of times we'll make the recommendation that your car is so old that maybe it's not the best investment to put this money in, where you could take this money and put it into the next car.
Mm-hmm. One of the things when using this analogy as the car doctor, what else should you be looking for? You talked about this certification. How widespread is this certification?
So this certification is all over the United States.
How many people take advantage of it, though? Is it spread quite a bit around?
There's about 300,000 currently certified professionals. The thing that I want consumers to understand is that if a technician passes one test, so say they pass the suspension and steering test, then they get a patch and a certificate that makes them ASC certified. And I brought you pictures because no one else can see, but that way at least you understand. So they get these certifications that list which test, which system they have passed. And they should be hung up in the shop so that customers can see what they are. So I think it's important for consumers to be asking, so, okay, you told me that my car needs brakes and how much it's going to be, and you showed me, so I understand all that. But the guy who's going to be working on the brakes, is he ASC certified in brakes? Because you don't know. And this goes for independents or dealerships. It's all the same testing for, because the testing is on the mechanic. The certification goes with the mechanic, not the repair center. So I think it's important to know who's working on your car, because a lot of times you don't know. Even if you're at the dealership, do you have their master tech? Do you have the guy who is certified in that specific system? Or do you have the guy that just came out of, you know, say the school down in Randolph, you know, the technical school. So they went to school for 2 years. They came out with a degree, but in reality, they don't have the experience yet. So I think it's important to know. The other thing that's cool about the certification is once a technician passes all 8 of those tests, then he becomes a master technician. And so when someone has on the master technician patch, and they have these patches that the technicians can put on their uniforms, it lets you know, okay, if someone has passed 8 of these tests, they know, they pretty much know what they're doing. They have the experience, and they have the pride and the wherewithal to take the time and the energy to take the test. They have pride in what they're doing.
We're speaking with Amy Matinat, who's the owner of Auto Craftsman, and we're talking about how do you assess who you should be going to and the reasons why for a mechanic in terms of the skill level of the mechanic you're working on. It's always been a question I've always wondered. And we're not conditioned yet, at least I'm not, of going into a car repair shop, whether it's a dealership or in, and asking these questions. Mm-hmm. You sort of feel that you're being intrusive, yet you would do it with a doctor. You'd make sure that a doctor is certified. You'd make sure. Do you see people starting to recognize that these are questions you should be asking about the place you go to have your car repaired?
I think it's a new movement with the ASC program to educate consumers. They have spent all these years really focusing on creating the tests, because the tests are a really big deal. And as you can imagine, they're always changing. They've always have to update them because technology changes. And for a technician to keep his certification, whether it's, you know, in that one system, whether it's in 5, whether they're a master tech, and there's actually another highest level, which is the certified advanced level specialist. And this guy is like the cardiologist, the surgeon. These are the guys that can really diagnose the very deep, hard to find engine performance. But they have to get recertified every 5 years. They have to retake these tests because, again, the technology changes. So as a whole, the national nonprofit ASC is starting a program to educate consumers about the certification. So then they understand and they can go in and ask those questions.
You talked about a process that seems reasonable to me, you know, having the person drive with you and listen and then putting it up on the lift, showing you the problem before you even start working on the automobile. That is a process that isn't universally done. And many people will walk into a place and feel that they're getting the bill run up on them, that there are issues that, you know, are being taken care of that weren't issues. How do you protect yourself as a consumer against this?
So I give a lot of women car care clinics, and I want to empower my students so that they feel like they have some control over the process. So we'll pretend you're in my class. And so what I tell them is that 99% of auto repair centers are trying to do their best for you. A lot of times the person you're talking to started out as a technician. Now, technicians, a good technician is good at what he does because of the way his brain work. And they tend to be, I kind of think of it as a thoroughbred racehorse with the little blinders by their eyes, because they're so focused on what they're doing, and that's how they're able to fix things. So when you take them out of that position and you put them as the person who's trying to explain it to you, they're not always the best communicators, and that's where problem happens. 99% of when there's a problem with you and wherever you took your car in is, I call it, somebody dropped the ball on the communication. So what you can do as being the because you're the advocate for your patient, the car, is taking it step by step, asking all the right questions. So you need to kind of set it up. So you want to be a good advocate for your car. So you go in and you say, here's my car. It's pulling to the right, but it only happens when I'm on the highway. It doesn't seem to happen when I'm going slow. Could a mechanic come for a road test with me so I can show them? So again, you know, you're not waiting for them to ask you, because they might not have thought of it. Is it possible for someone to go for a road test with me? And that's a good indication. If they say no, then you're like, okay, maybe you can find a mechanic who will, because it's so much easier to explain. Because again, it's a complicated technical thing. So for you to try to explain it verbally to the person on the front without them understanding what you're seeing, or if there's something weird hanging down, can I show you? Will you come out here so I can show you? Because you can try to explain it. So it's this weird plastic thing on the right side, and then people get real confused of which is the right and which is the left side of the car, because we say the driver's side is the left and the passenger side is the right.
When we come back, I want to turn a little bit broader questions on some of the things like the most common mistake people make with their car. Why, you know, what are some of the problems that you see as well? But we've got to take a short break, and when we come back, I'll discuss that. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. In studio with me is Amy Matinat, owner of Auto Craftsman, and we're talking about cars and car repairs. Amy, if you wish to join the conversation, and I wish you would, if you have any questions or concerns about your car, 802-244-1777 or toll-free at 877-291-8255. The question should be on what do you look for when you're servicing your car? And one of the things that I'm just finding out about this, Amy, is that what you do up front will kind of determine what your experience is. Is that right?
That's correct. Yeah, you want to kind of set the stage for everything. So as we were talking about consumers, you know, empowering a consumer is number one, you don't want to have unrealistic expectations. So I'll start out from the our side of the table is, if you have a weird noise or the car is doing something really weird, don't come in and say, okay, so I'm dropping my car off at 9 and I need to pick up my kid at 1 and it's making this weird noise, okay? Because you can't do it in that amount of time. So for, you know, a regular service, it just needs an oil change, it just needs the tire swapped over, that's okay to, like, give the time limits. But when it's diagnosing and testing, we need time to do it. But it should be two stages. So you need to set it up. Okay, so my car is making this weird noise. We went on the road test. We come back. So my understanding, Mr. Technician, is that you're going to test and diagnose what's wrong, and then you're going to call me and explain it, and then you're going to tell me how much it'll cost, and then I'll tell you whether I want to do the work or not, right? So that way you've set up the kind of like how it's going to go down.
And that's important in setting
up. I think it's really important, because if not, you may get someone who's, you know, they find, so maybe there's an axle broken and they're like, oh my God, this person could have died, and they just order it and fix it. And then they call you and they think, I mean, this happens all the time. They think, I just saved your life, and it's going to, you know, it costs you, you know, $450. And you're like, what? I don't have $450. You didn't call me. So there's that lack of communication where the shop thought they were really taking care of you, but they didn't communicate to you. It's that lack of communication. So you need to set the stage of, this is, you know, this is how it needs to go down. And then I always just like to tell my girls, as you look at them and say, okay, and they say, okay, so now you have agreement on how it's going to go. And if it is that, you know, I just need an oil change and you need the car back by, you know, 2 o'clock so you can pick up your kid at soccer, make sure you tell them, because when you drop off your car, you're not the only car. There's, you know, there could be anywhere from 5 to 15, 20 cars coming in that day. And if it's just an oil change and they have like 8 oil changes and you didn't say specifically, I need it by 2, they can't read your mind. So you got to be really clear. It's all about communication.
Any other tips?
You know, I always go through the thing of when you're explaining things to people of, you know, to the front end of what's wrong with your car, visually, you know, did you see some fluid on the ground? If so, what color was it? Was it in the front, the back? Did you hear anything? Did something feel warm? You know, there's all those things. And then we get to taste, and I say, don't taste anything, because that would be bad. But you could bring some cookies in, and, you know, will the shop, like, give you a little bit extra treatment if you bring the cookies? Absolutely. We love cookies. We, you know, it's they're working hard for you. They're the ones that keep your vehicle reliable, and they keep your family safe on the road. So a little bit of appreciation goes a long way, because those guys work so hard. It's a complicated job, and it's physically, you know, it's also like doctors, they go in there and they, you know, it's very mental and hard to do, but it's not as physical as car doctors. So I have such admiration and appreciation of a good technician. And I think if a consumer or a driver has that appreciation for their car doctor, you know, it's just, it's all about relationships, and you want to have a good relationship with your car doctor.
Let me ask you this question, because I heard you say, you know, you should go in and check and talk about certifications.
Mm-hmm.
But for some reason, I get this reaction of, if I go in and ask for certifications, is the dealership, is the car repair place, are they expecting that? And what is the reaction to that sort of thing?
I think if they have the certifications, they're going to be very proud to show you. It's a pride thing. I've had lots of technicians come in who had no certifications, because you have to pay money for it. So I always just pay for it. You know, I'm like, I want the certifications, because I'm not a technician. And so just as a driver will gauge the level of the skill and the experience of the technician through certifications, I do too. So if I have a technician that comes in with, like, you know, 10 years of experience, and I make the phone calls of all the other places they've worked, and they've gotten really good reviews from the other, you know, shops they've worked at, part of them coming in is, I want the certifications, because it's important to me. It's important to my customers. So I pay for the certifications, and they all come in. They say, I don't need that, because, you know, I know that I know what I know. And I say, that's fine, but it's important to me. So if you want to work here, then you're going to get your certifications. And when they reach their master certification, because I really only want to hire master technicians, they stand taller, and they're proud. they're very proud. And I get the patches and I put them on their uniform. And so when I introduce them to the, you know, I'll bring a customer out and say, this is your technician. I want you to notice he's an ASC master certified technician. This guy is a rocket scientist and he's going to explain to you what's wrong with your car. And he stands taller and the customer looks at him a little differently. There's this whole thing about our industry that what I look at AC certifications also does is that it makes people look different at our industry because it's auto science and it's car doctors. And there's so many young people who have the potential to be a really good tech. And their parents are like, oh, no, you need to go to college. And so they put roadblocks in front of these, you know, young people who want to come into the automotive industry, which is wide open. There are not enough auto doctors out there to service all the cars. There's a shortage of good technicians.
So what do you send them to, the physician assistants?
Well, they have schools that they can go to. And then they come out of the schools and they go through apprenticeship programs. I mean, it's kind of just like what a doctor does. He goes into the, you know, when a doctor comes out of school, you don't want him doing open heart surgery on you. I mean, you ever see like Grey's Anatomy where they're the little baby doctors and slowly they start letting them stitch things? It's kind of like that when they come out of school. We watch them step by step and make sure that they got this piece until you let them on their own.
Let me ask you, are there other certifications that you could be looking for, or is this it? Is this the...
Well, the cool thing is a lot of people will look for AAA-approved auto repair centers. One of the criteria to become a AAA auto repair center is that the technicians are ASC certified, so they go together.
So this is like a universal certification?
Yes, this is the big one. This is the one that really shows where the technician is at. And then they're like the AAA shows you where the level of the shop is at. And there's also a blue seal of excellence that ASC certifies the shop, where it's 75% of their staff has ASC certifications.
When we come back, I want to sort of change the subject a little bit. And if you want to join our conversation, we're talking with Amy Matinat, owner of Auto Craftsman. But we're talking about what you should be looking for when you choose a mechanic, which is a very important decision that you make every day. It can cost you thousands if you make the wrong decision. Give us a call at 802-244-1777 or toll free at 877-291-8255. I want to talk about how did you get into this business, and we'll talk about that in a minute. This is Open Mic. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. We're talking with Amy Matinat, and we're talking about your mechanic. When you go in and get your car serviced, what sort of questions should you be asking of your mechanic? Give us a call if you are curious about what experience you should have when you go in to get your car repaired. Give us a call at 802-244-1777 or toll free at 877-291-8255. Let's go to Howard in Greensboro. Howard, you're on Open Mic with Amy Matinat.
Yes, I wanted to ask Amy what her thinking was on the DMV's new thing about inspecting cars and the cost it's going to cost her.
Go ahead, Howard.
I myself think it's going to be only an advantage to the car to the dealerships that upsell when you bring your car in for repairs. I think it's going to be a definite benefit to them, but not going to be any benefit to the customer.
That's a great question, Howard. It was actually on my list. We were starting to run out of time, but that's a great question. What about the new requirements for inspection?
So I don't have a complete understanding of it. In fact, tomorrow I'm going to DMVs. They're having like a little workshop class to explain to us what it entails. My understanding, and this is I'm not absolutely sure about this, my understanding is that it's all about the emissions and that it's a way for the state to monitor if the check engine light is on then we're connecting their machine, which we have to invest in, and it's over $1,000. So we invest in this machine. We hook it up to the OBD port, OBD2 port of your car, and that goes to the state. So they would then know if the check engine light is on. And then we are able to take pictures of things that are broken that need to be repaired. That would go to the state. And then you would not get your sticker until the check engine light is off, until the repairs are done. That's as much as I know, and I'm going to find out tomorrow because I'm just as curious about it as you are, because it's going to slow things down as far as doing the inspections. And big investment, $1,000 is, you know, not pocket change. So we'll see.
Let me ask you this question, Amy. How did you get into this business?
So I'm originally from Ohio, outside Youngstown, Cleveland, Akron, Pittsburgh, Motorhead capital of the world. My first boyfriend was a Motorhead, became a technician. I went to school at Paul Smith College over in the Adirondacks, which got me to New England. And my first husband was a mechanic. I opened two shops with him. So I kind of spent, you know, most of my adult life in shops, you know, hand me this tool, put your finger here, pump the brakes, you know, helping out. I never wanted to be a technician and actually work on my own car. I have incredible admiration and appreciation for good technicians. And I ended up doing the books for Auto Craftsman, you know, over 20 years ago, part-time, eventually became the service writer for 8 years, eventually became the partner, and then I bought my partner out 7 years ago, and now it's my baby.
What is the most common mistake that people make with their car?
I think they get emotionally attached to it. And
really?
Yes. We have plenty of people who, they've kept the car too long. But I love my car. I love my car. Your car doesn't care. Sorry, it's just a machine. The other thing I would say is they don't maintain it. The best thing you can do for your car is to get your oil changed at regular intervals, to have a great relationship with your car doctor and bring it to the same place every time. A lot of people, they are looking for the cheapest oil change. So I call them shop hoppers, and they just go from, you know, hop to hop to hop looking for those 1995 oil changes. And those type of oil changes, it's all about speed. So they're just like zip, 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 oil change done, off you go. And they aren't looking. So if you bring your car somewhere for anything and they're not looking it over, you may think they're looking for, you know, to make money off me. No, you want them to look, because if they spot something that needs repaired, you want to know about that before it breaks, it leaves you on the side of the road, because it can cost more money if you don't just, you know, fix it than waiting for it to break.
What's the most common problem you see?
The most common problem. Well, I think the biggest problem in Vermont is rust. Is since they started using the salt brine, we've always had a rust problem, but it's accelerated it. They now put molasses in the salt brine, so it sticks to the road and it sticks to your car. And even if you take it to the car wash, it doesn't, you know, you almost need a scrub brush out there scrubbing. So you really need to get your car undercoated these days in Vermont.
We're speaking with Amy Matinat, who's the owner of the Auto Craftsman. We're talking about the things you should know when you go to get your car repaired. Let's go to Bill in White River. Bill, you're on open mic. Good morning.
Good morning. Nice job, Amy. But there's a question here about finances and all of this. You think it's good for the consumer to know what your price point is on repairs, how much your mechanics get per hour? And that's A. And the B part. And then I'll hang up. The B part is, it's too bad there's not insurance for ongoing repairs like there is for the real doctors out there who are covered by insurance for what they do. Thank you, and I'm anxious to hear your answer.
Bill, great questions. Amy?
They are very good questions. So I'm going to do the insurance first. You know, in the whole medical insurance is so screwed up that I would never want it to go down that road. To have to be calling the insurance companies periodically, we'll have to deal with someone will come in, they were in an accident, we got to deal with the insurance for, you know, some kind of repair. It's a nightmare. the amount of time we spend on the phone. So I would never want to go that route. My biggest recommendation is that once you're done paying those car payments, you're never done. That money should then go into a savings account. So if you were used to paying $150, $250 bucks a month to, you know, buy your car, once you've paid it off, that money then goes into a savings account. And then when your car breaks, you're ready for it. So that's my answer for that. As far as knowing the price, I really feel like you get what you pay for. And there are – I'll use a restaurant analogy. So there are McDonald's auto repair shops. There are, you know, coffee corners, and there's Sarducci's. So there's different levels. If a shop is going to hire ASC certified master technicians, they have to pay them. They get paid a lot of money. And so you get what you pay for. I think you should really look at the cost of the specific repair and service, not so much what anybody is getting paid for. That's up to the shop. And then the more they offer you, the more it's going to cost. You know, do they have a shuttle service? Do they have loaner cars? Do they have a waiting room that is so comfortable that you could bring your kid in and they can play on the floor while you're getting your car repaired? So it all depends on what you want, but there is a repair shop out there that will meet your needs. You just have to do your due diligence, find the right shop, ask the right questions, and create that relationship.
The cars, I would imagine, are becoming much more sophisticated in how you repair them, how you diagnose a problem and how you repair them. Does that add to the cost of getting things repaired nowadays?
Yes, big time. The amount of money that I have invested in scan tools is scary. And once you own a scan tool, it's not a done deal because every year you have to update it. And you know, my one scan tool, I just updated it. Oh, it was only $1,000 to update it. And that's just one of many. And then the scan tool does not always tell you this is what's wrong. It'll say, oh, it's over there, and now you need to do some testing. So we have three online subscriptions that we pay every month, and you know, their monthly fees, because once they find the codes, then they have to then go to the computer, start doing research to then do the testing to then tell you what's wrong with your car. So yeah, it's so complicated.
Got a couple minutes left here. I do want to bring up the issue. You've been at the forefront of breast cancer awareness. Can you explain what's going on in that area?
So there's this doctor in Cleveland, Dr. Vincent Tuohy, and he's an immunologist, and he's created this vaccine that prevents breast cancer in mice. I have two friends that have shops in Cleveland. They met him, and they kind of adopted him. So they started this, we call it Free Breaks for Breasts. And so it started out, there were five shops, and then the next year there were 15 shops, and now it's grown. I think we're in the seventh year, and there's 150 shops participating. So if you wanted information, you could go to breaksforbreasts.com, and all the money that we raise, 100% of the fundraiser goes to Dr. Tuohy. And he's a really cool guy. When I went to visit my folks in Ohio, I actually got to go out to lunch with him. Talk about someone who is passionate about what he's doing. Wouldn't it be an incredible thing that women could go and just get a vaccine that would prevent the breast cancer, and they would never have to have surgery, radiation, chemotherapy?
I mean, and you're a survivor, right?
I am a survivor, yes. And I have a daughter, and I would love for her to get this vaccine so she doesn't have to go through what I went through.
Amy, it's always great when you come in. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Mike.
That's Amy Matinat, and she is the owner of Auto Craftsman here in the area. And I thought it was important for us to know what questions you should be asking when you're going into a mechanic. Sometimes these repairs can be very expensive, and you want to ask the right questions. It's almost, as Amy said, as going into the doctor. Sometimes it's just as expensive. So you really want to know what questions to ask. I really want to thank our guest today, Jared Carter, who was with us with the Burlington, talking about the Burlington downtown redevelopment project and why he was opposed to it. Ellen Ratner from Talk Media News telling us what's going on in Las Vegas for tonight. We'll be talking about Las Vegas probably tomorrow for a little while. And also Amy Matinat, owner of Auto Craftsman, and her take on what's going on with what questions should you ask when you're going in and seeing your mechanic. Tomorrow we'll have Tom Humder, who is the CEO of the Rutland Regional Medical Center, and I think we're going to have some other guests as well. Yes, we are. We're going to be talking about the Tech Jam coming up in Burlington, coming up shortly in Burlington. I think it's this weekend. Plus your phone calls on the debate. That's going to be happening tonight. This is Open Mic, and you are listening to locally owned and operated WDEV News Radio on the Friendly Pioneer, celebrating its 85th year anniversary this year. WDEV AM 550, broadcasting from Waterbury and Montpelier, 96.1 FM from Warren, 96.5 FM from Barrie, and 98.3 FM from Montpelier, and serving the kingdom at 101.9 FM from Island Pond. Of course, we're streaming worldwide at WDEVradio.com, and you can listen to the Open Mic Podcast by going onto that website and clicking on the Open Mic Podcast. I'm Mike Smith. Thank you for your phone calls today. Great number of phone calls and great phone calls. Have a great rest of your day, and we'll talk again tomorrow.
The Open Mic Podcast is brought to you by Hickok Boardman, Dennis Ricker and Brown.
Find us online at hbinsurance.com, and you're always welcome to visit us on Facebook. In Vermont, online, on the phone. Hickok and Boardman Insurance Group. We are here when you need us.